America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Ripkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Ripkin along with John Krofcik. And John, everything that we talk about on America Trends really portends that there's a better future ahead, that there are a lot of issues that we're grappling with, but that ultimately there are solutions, there are ways forward. And it's really an interesting thing, John. I would love to be at about the year 2031. I really would, because I'd love to see how we have resolved some of the polarization in this country, how we've used technology to help us deal with the climate crisis. I'd love to see how we have been able really to overcome some of the issues that we've had related to income inequality, whether in fact we need ever to have another pandemic like this, or whether we have developed the solutions based on the vaccine that we have now developed. I would love to be 10 years ahead to see how we solve these problems.
Well, Larry, I hope it doesn't take that long. I'd say we need, something to happen to get people to start working together. I think sooner than that, because things are going, it's just crazy. The world is upside down.
Well, yes, it is. But John, think about this. You and I stepped onto this earth in the 1950s, right? Is that when you stepped on?
That's true.
Okay. So we have seen advances, changes that our parents never could have foreseen. And it really stands the test of time that if you look at any generation and you ask them to imagine the possibility and all the hopefulness that really is there in the world for us to grab a hold of, to capture, and to really make our own. We have a lot of control. We really do. And we have made so many things better. Imagine our parents thinking about the digital technology that you and I are using right now to communicate, and the fact that we're podcasting, which is something they had no clue what that was.
Well, wow, think about, you're right, and the advances in medical technology, how we're living so much longer. I mean, you're right. There is a lot of positive things, and to the future, as with a lot of people we have on this podcast, I think there is a lot of positive things to the future that are even going to take this a step further than we've seen it.
I mean, think about it, John. When you and I stepped onto this world, we took so many things for granted. We took the beauty of the Taj Mahal for granted. We took the enormity of the skyscraper known as the Empire State Building. I mean, somebody did that. Somebody built all those bridges so we could get in and out of Manhattan. We had so much already there for us. And now it's our turn. We're now at a point where we have got to take that which was given to us, because we've let a lot of it go to neglect, and we've got to build a better future. And we've done so many things in this interim period to make new developments and new innovations easier to accomplish. And so in many ways, John, this podcast is based on today, John, is called Future Rising. Andrew Maynard, PhD, a fascinating gentleman, and we are going to embark with him on a journey into the future. And don't be afraid. It's something that I think he's going to guide us into very gently and very appropriately, with a great deal of hope and sense of the possibility. And that's what I'm proud that we're doing today, John, on America Trends. With me on America Trends is Dr. Andrew Maynard, and he's written a new book called Future Rising. And he is a professor in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society at Arizona State University. And you decided to use an astronaut to write the foreword to your book. A retired astronaut who, living from space, tells us that the Earth has no borders and nothing to stop us from being the best of collaborators, to form the best teams, to collectively bring our imaginations to bear to solve the critical problems of our times. That's a really optimistic theme that your foreword puts out.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, so Katie is a good friend, but also her foreword ties in with where the book starts, with Bill Anders' image of the Earth rising above the horizon of the moon. It is optimistic, and this is one of the things that surprised me writing the book, about how optimistic I actually felt about the future, despite everything that we face in life.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because then I went to your introduction. We live in a world in turmoil. As I write, we are grappling with a future-changing global pandemic. Refugees are being held in less than human conditions as they strive to build a better future. A growing wave of populism and nationalism is sparking another type of global epidemic. And yet, you too, as we move along, are very optimistic. You might not gather that from the opening of your writing.
Right. And so you can probably tell that when I started writing this, I was struggling with this question of how do we build a better future when everything seems to be going to pot in the world around us? And so that sort of framed those opening statements. And yet what to me is very clear and became very clear as I was writing this is that despite everything that seems to be wrong in the world, we as a species are so incredibly good at imagining a better future and taking steps to build it, that I think that beyond the challenges that we face at the moment, there is tremendous hope. But that hope also comes with responsibility. It's one of those things where there is the potential to build a much better future, but we've got to step up to the plate and do that. It won't just happen naturally.
I think it's interesting because lately I've been writing a lot of song lyrics, and often things just strike me. And one of the things that I'm struck with, though I haven't figured out, Dr. Maynard, a way to make this into a song lyric yet, is how when I stepped onto this earth in 1952, so I'm a man of 68 years, so much had already happened. So much had really been put in place so that I didn't have to worry about some of the basic aspects of life that people 100 years earlier were struggling with. And I really had to be grateful for that.
Right. And I think it's really easy to forget how grateful we should be, certainly in the West and in certain communities, because we have life incredibly easy compared to previous generations. But there's also, I think, a flip side to this, and this is something that I take my students through when we talk about these issues, and that is, even though we live in a world where we have incredible capacity to cure diseases, to ensure people have not only got the ability to make a living, but to live a really vibrant life, there are many people that don't have those opportunities. And so to me, one of the challenges is, how do we spread the wealth of future optimism around? How do we make this accessible to everybody rather than just the few? Because we certainly have the capability to.
Oh, absolutely. And your book points that out so beautifully with your short chapters about the various aspects of who we are and what tools we have available to us to do that. You say that imagination, hope, and possibility are the key tools in solving the problems that we face.
This was another thing that intrigued me as I was writing this. So I'm a scientist. I've spent many years as a lab scientist doing what scientists do. And yet, it became patently apparent to me when I was writing this that you can't build a better future through science alone. You've got to understand what it is that makes us human and uniquely human. You've got to understand what it is that brings value to our lives and what it is that makes us incredibly powerful, what I call architects of the future. And that gets to things like sort of how we imagine the future, our creativity, our ability to see in our mind's eye how things could be different and then work out how to get there.
When we look at the level of sophistication that human beings really have developed, and you say, for example, we're about to master biology, create machines that can think in conquering seemingly incurable diseases, and yet we accept lies from leaders and make wearing a mask political. Well, I think I added that. I mean, I guess my question is, when you look on balance at the capability of the human species to rise above any of the previous limitations of another generation, another time, another set of experiences or knowledge, and yet we seem so incapable at times of assimilating information, and we go backward in the way that we look at things.
Yeah, we have this incredible ability to shoot ourselves in the foot and to rip victory from, or I guess it's rip sort of despair from the jaws of victory, whatever the saying is. So this is a conundrum. So I steer a little bit around this in the book, but this is really important because there is this huge chasm between what we're capable of and what we actually end up doing. And I think it's more complex than many people think of this. So it's easy to say, well, people are just not smart. End of story, that you've got the smart people that know how to build a better future and the not smart people who seem to just trip themselves up or shoot themselves in the foot. The reality is that we've all got a little bit of both of those people in us. We all have the ability to do amazing things, and we all have the ability to just make an awful mess of things. And I think that this comes down to me, and I mention this in the book, of having the humility to understand our own limitations as well as the ability of others. And just to underline that, so you look at some of the things that are going on in the world at the moment where people seem to be taking such illogical stances on so many different things and throwing sort of fact and evidence and reason out of the window and embracing things that make no sense whatsoever. You can look at that from a distance and say, this is just incredibly dumb. Who are these people? What are they doing? And yet if you take each of those people individually and talk them through why they're making the decisions they're making, why they're doing what they're doing, it's amazing how much reasoning there is behind that. And the reality is we've all got these sort of biases in our heads. We've all got these sort of really warped ways of seeing the world where we can sort of construct these sort of logical sort of ways forward that seem illogical to other people. And we do that not because we're dumb, but because we're humans. And as soon as we understand that, we can understand how better to help people sort of move together to build a better future rather than just sort of rip apart the opportunities that we have.
In many ways, as I read through your book, I was looking for a way that I could concretize some of these ideas. And one thing that came to me, maybe it's sloganeering, but that we're built to survive. In other words, you know, no matter what the challenge is, and if you go through history, this generation, the younger people, they're going through a lot. They went through 9/11 in America. They went through a recession that had great enormity and impact. Now they're going through the pandemic. But if you go back historically and you go back to 1918 and that generation, two world wars, a pandemic, and all kinds of less sophistication in medicine and science, I mean, they really went through even more, and we are built to survive.
We really are. And as a species, we're quite incredible at that. And this actually comes back to where some of those seemingly illogical actions, you can understand them stemming from this inbuilt desire and impetus to survive and thrive no matter what. The challenge, of course, comes when those instincts don't match the world we're building around us. So even look at the world now compared to what it was 100 years ago. It is so dominated by advanced science and technology that our survival instincts really don't equip us, if we're not careful, to thrive in this sort of world. And as a result, if we listen too closely to those instincts, we have the possibility or the likelihood of going down pathways that are only going to lead to disaster. So then the challenge is, how do we listen to those instincts when they make sense and follow our gut when it makes sense, but how do we modulate that with a more informed understanding of when our gut might be wrong and we need to think differently?
You know, there are a lot of people who might listen to a podcast like this and say, I've got so many problems in my immediate existence, that my ability to fashion that future that we're talking about, or be part of being on the cutting edge. For example, I have a cousin who's married to the man who actually was the number 12 employee at Intel, and he led the group that developed the microprocessor. So he has changed the world. I mean, literally. But there are many of us who say, I can't even get out of my own way. I can't, you know, figure out how to make a living at this moment in time and support my family. What role do I play in this future that you say we have to take responsibility for, each of us, but I'm too mired in my own needs?
This is such an important point, and I think too many people that are given the luxury to think about these things forget that the majority of people struggling with a whole hope of challenges just to get through life to the other end. And so I really sympathize with people who say, I need to get a roof over my head, I need to get food on the table, I need to work two jobs in order to survive. What can I possibly do? And yet the reality is that we all have the ability to do things, even at a very small scale. And whether that's just being aware of what other people are doing with technology innovation and how it might affect our lives, to being part of conversations that will begin to nudge things in a different way. And those conversations could be as small as talking to friends, talking to neighbors, just beginning to think, even in those few minutes that we have free, about what it means to be alive at the moment and have some influence, no matter how small, on the type of future we want to build together. And even if you're somebody who is struggling with a lot of stuff, it's possible to make those really small steps. As soon as you begin to think about what is happening in the world that might impact you and the people you care for, and what can you do to try and nudge things in a better direction. But at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. I think too often we make the mistake of assuming that everybody has got the time and the luxury to sort of be these major change makers. Most people don't, but we can make small differences.
Dr. Andrew Maynard is with us. The book is called Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow. How important is it, because you do tie the past to the present and then into the future, to really have an understanding of our past, or at least an appreciation that if you ever think that this is where we stop, and the present is as good as it gets, or the past was better, you might want to look back and recognize that, in fact, that is not necessarily the case, and we need to continue marching forward and set whatever metaphorical reset button we can.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's easy to get mired in the past, either through nostalgia or through despair. It's also incredibly easy to just replicate mistakes of the past. It seems like no matter how optimistic I am, sometimes we just don't learn from our mistakes. So to me, what is really important is not necessarily getting into the minutiae of the past and the minutiae of history, but getting a better appreciation and understanding of the foundations that we've built, and most importantly, this connection between cause and effect, that the fact that because we live in a universe governed by the laws of physics, everything we do, everything that happens in the past, has some sort of impact on the future. And the more we understand that, the more we can understand how to find those levers to pull and those buttons to push that will help us build a better future. So this to me is where sometimes I talk about sort of taking time out and sort of hitting the reset button. Sometimes I think we just need to find that space to rethink what that means in terms of the fact that the things we do affect the future. And so not only we have a responsibility there, but we have an opportunity to mindfully choose the things that we do and why we do them and how we do them, if we understand at least roughly how those might have a ripple-on effect into the future.
How do you approach this topic with young people at Arizona State? Because they may come into your class thinking, oh, good, we're going to be talking about AI. We're going to be talking about super computers. We're going to be talking about the ability to implant something into my brain, edit my genes, whatever it may be. And you're talking to them more philosophically the role of innovation, the human spirit, the human touch in all of this. But they may want to talk about all the whiz-bang.
and I do talk about the whiz bang. And I, how could I not, being a scientist and a person who's just sort of in awe with technology? So to me, the two go together. You've got the awe and the wonder of what we're doing with technology innovation. And there, I think it's really important not only to get into the details of what we're doing, say, with things like gene editing or artificial intelligence or other areas, but actually get excited about it. This is incredibly exciting stuff. But at the same time, if you had the excitement without the understanding of consequences, we're setting ourselves up for failure. So this is what I do with my students. We both talk about the excitement and the actual plausible things we can do with the technology. And then we talk about what that means and what might go wrong and what are the factors that lead to things potentially going wrong. And then how can we take actions to correct that, especially with the new generations coming up? What can they learn about developing new technologies in responsible ways that ensure that people really see the benefits without the downsides?
Do you think that we spend enough time thinking about the ethical quandaries that a lot of these innovations present us with?
We don't. And to me, this is one of the really sad aspects of how we train and educate the next generation. We don't equip them to think about how to understand the potential consequences. And I include sort of ethics in there, but it's really looking at what are the consequences of what we're doing and how to navigate that. And it gets down to even small things like, how do you decide which the appropriate research questions to ask? How do you decide, as you translate that research into new technologies, what those technologies look like? How do you identify where those technologies might be biased against certain people and harm people in unexpected ways? To me, these are all critical questions which really should be embedded in the ways we teach science and engineering and technology. And sadly, they're not, or not half as much as they need to be.
A lot of people think that the arc of history bends toward more justice, more peace, more sophistication in our thinking. But then there are others. I was reading a book for another podcast that I did, and they were talking about Enrico Fermi and his principle, sitting down at lunch with other thinkers, somewhat equivalent to his own intellect. And they asked him about whether he thought there was life beyond Earth. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, if a society were that sophisticated that they could reach out to us, the likelihood is that they probably already destroyed themselves before they could reach us. And
right.
When you think about it, overnight, this planet could be obliterated by bad decisions by just a handful of leaders across the globe. I mean, so are we in a race against time with our better selves or our worse selves?
So I think we are, but this is one of those questions where it's almost impossible to answer, because we are incapable, largely incapable of seeing the future in any other way than the constraints of our own human mind and our own human experience. So you look at what Fermi said there, it was based on his own perspective of the world around him. It wasn't necessarily the right perspective or the most accurate perspective, but it was all he knew. And all of us fall into this trap. So it's impossible to tell what might be possible, but it's easy for us to speculate about what we imagine could happen. And there it's very easy to tell ourselves stories about how we might destroy the world. And I'm exactly the same. So I do worry that we're really sitting on a knife edge of as a society where there are things we could do, either intentionally or unthinkingly, that'll lead us down a very dark pathway indeed. It may not lead to the eventual wiping out of humanity, but it'll lead to a future which is far worse than the present. And that's one of the things that really motivates me to not only ask questions about how we build a better future, but how to get people thinking about how to do that, because I do worry about it. But who's to say whether my worries are right or wrong? It's almost impossible for us to come out of ourselves and see the world through non-human eyes.
All of the human characteristics that help us to shape the future, not just be a bystander looking on. And you also say that the process of evolution in DNA suggests a pathway to a slightly better future. So help us to understand that.
Yeah, so this actually gets very philosophical in some ways, but at a very practical level. You look at the emergence of DNA as this molecule that is now part and parcel of every aspect of life. it is an unbelievably versatile molecule. And I think we haven't even scratched the surface, even on evolutionary sort of terms, or even on human engineering terms, on what we can do with this base molecule in terms of changing life and changing the nature of life, hopefully for the better. So that to me is really exciting. But the more philosophical side of this gets to the laws of physics and this idea of entropy, that the universe is running down. The universe sort of, in the big picture, never gets sort of better. It's sort of, it's heading towards what astronomers and cosmologists call heat death. And there is a theory that the amazing things that humanity and life on Earth are capable of because of DNA is actually accelerating our pathway towards heat death, simply because we're much better at using energy or abusing energy, which is sort of all part of this sort of pathway towards heat death. So we as humans, the more sophisticated we get, the better we get at using energy faster. And the more energy we use and the faster we use it, the faster the universe winds down. So that's, to me, a really interesting paradox, where we're in a bubble where we're getting better. We're probably going to get better for the next few thousand years, millennia or whatever. But ultimately, this is a pathway towards the universe eventually stopping faster.
You say that we have future sense. In other words, when you think about animals, and you'll help me with this, they think in the moment. They think at the present. You have a bad episode with your dog and you scold the dog. The next second they're there, you know, wanting your attention and your love. We have a future sense based on instinct to avoid harm to ourselves. I mean, when you think about, you know, in the old days, somebody running around with a loincloth trying to avoid a lion, that doesn't really happen today. We have equipped ourselves with the capability of extinguishing that danger. So that is one of the capabilities of the human species.
It is. And and of course, other species have got some sort of rudimentary future sense. They can learn from what happened in the past as they developed. And of course, it's baked into their genes as well. But humans have got this incredible tool set of future senses. I mean, everything from our instinct or our gut sense to our intellect. And what amazes me is we have this capacity, we don't always use it, but we have this capacity both to instinctively respond to things, and that actually helps us out a lot, surprisingly enough, but we can augment that with our intellect, our ability to think logically about what is right or what is wrong. And that puts us head and shoulders above any other species, because it means that we can begin to tie together those threads of cause and effect and work out how to manipulate them to change the future.
Let me ask about climate change. Let's get to a very specific threat to the human species that we're now facing. There are many parts of the planet, ultimately, that may become less than habitable over time. That will cause great dislocation, movements of people, wars. There could be lack of water. There could be lack of lots of things that are necessary to sustain human life. So is this really the existential threat that humanity now faces? And what do you see happening in that regard? And how do we know that we're up to meeting that challenge?
To me, it's not an existential threat because humanity will survive. It's very, very hard to see a climate change scenario where humanity doesn't survive. But what will not survive is the quality of life that I think we should be looking at. This is one of the paradoxes of life on Earth. Life will go on, but whether humanity as we know it or want it to be as part of that is a different matter. So then as humans, I would say we have a responsibility and an obligation to ensure that our actions in the past and the present don't lead to a future that harms people and causes hurt and distress and death more than we can possibly help it. And of course, that is what we're looking at with climate change. And to me, this is where the imperative comes, not to say that we risk humanity being obliterated because of climate change, but looking at the distress that our actions are likely to cause for some parts of the global population and saying, this is not right, this is not appropriate, we all have a responsibility to prevent this happening.
I'd love for you to describe to any listener there the concept of emergence that you bring out in your book. And according to the law of physics, or the laws of physics, the universe's future should be getting increasingly chaotic. And yet, in many ways, as societies, we're getting more organized.
And this comes back to this sort of this little bubble where, even though if you take the long view, the universe is sort of winding down, we are in this little bubble that is accelerating that process by things becoming more and more complex. And I must say, this is something that has intrigued, confounded scientists for decades and decades now. Why does life seem to be getting more complex? Why does the world seem to be getting more complex when the nature of things is to become less complex? And there are no clear answers to this. What we do know is that we live on this planet where, because of a number of factors, the situation, the environment is ideal, both for this molecule of DNA to form and everything around it, and then for that to lead to organisms, animals, plants, humans eventually, that have this ability to organize everything around them. How you explain that, people explain it in different ways. In the book, I talk about explaining it in terms of this little bubble of complexity actually hastens the end of the universe, and eventually we'll see that sort of dissolve away and things become sort of far less complex in the future. But we're living in this rather luxurious period where we're seeing an increase in complexity, a little local bubble. But as you can see from the way I'm describing this, there are no easy, definitive ways of saying why life is getting more complex. The one thing I would say, though, is we should own this and revel in it. No matter what the explanation is, we live in a time when we can do incredible things. Let's do those incredible things.
You know, you go back to popular culture to help us understand what we're talking about. In 1984, The Terminator, the idea being the future is not set, there is no fate, but what we make for ourselves. Why don't you go back to that film, because you reference it in the book, and the lesson that we need to learn from that.
So it was partially a tie into my previous book, which used science fiction movies to explore some of these connections between technology and innovation and sort of the future and how to develop it responsibly. So it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, especially seeing that I love the Terminator movies or the earlier ones, and I couldn't get them into that first book. But it also really nicely demonstrates this idea that we don't have to be fatalistic, that the future isn't set, that we actually have some sort of control, some sort of ability to change the future for the better, if only we recognize that and step up to the plate.
You also reference John F. Kennedy and his encouragement that we're going to go to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard, because humanity, I think, needed to really explore beyond its own limits. And yet you do say to us that it wasn't that he was willing to sacrifice human life. He wasn't expecting there to be a lot of carnage on the way to the moon. It was through memory and learning that it's possible to change the future. And he was fully expecting that we would be able to conquer that as well, not because we were just going to sacrifice lots of humanity in the process.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think this is part of it, that this is a yes and equation where, yes, it's hard to build a better future, but it's something that we can do without casualties on the way if we put our minds to it.
In the second part of your book, you deal with feelings, faith, imagination, curiosity, fear, loss, despair. Is there anything among that collection of traits that you think we should focus on in the closing moments of our conversation?
I would say despair and hope. That's a section of the book which both looks at some of these less tangible aspects of what it means to be human, but it also gets to the darkest part of the book, especially when you get to despair. And to me, despair is being able to see what the future could be like, but having no way of getting there. And it's a state that can either occur naturally, or more worryingly, it's a state that can be imposed on us by others because they quite literally rob us of the future that we can imagine that we aspire to. And that, to me, has never been more important in the world we live in, where so many people have the ability to rob others of the future they aspire to, and in doing so, plunge them into despair. And I think it's a very poignant reminder that we all have a responsibility not to steal the future from other people, but to open up pathways to that future and to reduce despair in that way.
a wonderful way to close. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends and to talk about your incredible book. And it's very short, but very pithy. So you really have to focus on these chapters because in each is something that we can all take away. Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow. Andrew Maynard, PhD from Arizona State. Thank you so much for spending some of the present with us to talk about the future.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.